even Saturn with its many rings.
Or Mars with its twin orbs, said Mr. Wallacker, glancing, I swear, at my tits, before staring intently down at his papers.
Exactly, I got out in a strangled voice. But Mrs. Darcy, burst out Mr. Pitlochry Howard, with an air of injured pride, I personally am more fascinated by Uranus than... Thank you, I couldn't help myself saying, then just totally gave in to helpless laughter.
Mr. Pitlochry Howard, said Mr. Wallacker, pulling himself together, I think we have admirably made our point, and, he murmured in an undertone, I can quite see whence the giggling originates. Are there any more issues of concern with Billy's work?
No, no, grades are very good, gets on with the other boys. Very jolly, great little chap. Well, it's all down to you, Mr. Pitlochry Howard, I said creepily. All that teaching, thank you so much. Then, not daring to look at Mr. Wallacker, I got up and glided out of the hall. However, once outside, I sat in the car thinking I needed to go back in and ask Mr. Pitlochry Howard more about the homework, or maybe if Mr. Pitlochry Howard should, perchance, be busy, Mr. Wallacker. Back in the hall, Mr. Pitlochry Howard and Mr. Wallacker were talking to Nicolette and her handsome husband, who had his hand supportively on Nicolette's back. You're not supposed to listen to the other parents' consultations, but Nicolette was projecting so powerfully it was impossible not to. I just wonder if Atticus might be a little overextended, Mr. Pitlochry Howard was mumbling. He seems to have so many after-school clubs and playdates. He's a little anxious sometimes. He becomes despairing if he doesn't feel he is on top.
Where is he in the class? Said Nicolette. How far is he from the top?
She peered over at the chart, which Mr. Pitlochry Howard put his arm across. She flicked her hair crossly.
Why don't we know their relative performance levels? What are the class positions?
We don't do class positions, Mrs. Martinez, said Mr. Pitlochry Howard.
Why not? She said,
with a sort of apparently pleasant, casual inquisitiveness which conceals a swordsman poised behind the arras.
It's really about doing their personal best, said Mr. Pitlochry Howard.
Let me explain something, said Nicolette. I used to be CEO of a large chain of health and fitness clubs, which expanded throughout the UK and into North America. Now I am CEO of a family. My children are the most important, complex, and thrilling product I have ever developed. I need to be able to assess their progress relative to their peers in order to adjust their development.
Mr. Wallacker was watching her in silence. Healthy competition has its place, but when an obsession with relative position replaces a pleasure in the actual subject, Mr. Pitlochry Howard began nervously,
and you feel that extracurricular activities and playdates are stressing him out, said Nicolette.
Her husband put his hand on her arm. Darling.
These boys need to be rounded. They need their flutes. They need their fencing. Furthermore, she continued, I do not see social engagements as playdates. They are team-building exercises.
They are children, Mr. Wallacker roared. They are not corporate products. What they need to acquire is not a constant massaging of the ego, but confidence, fun, affection, love, a sense of self-worth. They need to understand now that there will always, always be someone greater and lesser than themselves, and that their self-worth lies in their contentment with who they are, what they are doing, and their increasing competence in doing it.
I'm sorry, said Nicolette. So there's no point trying.
Oh, I see.
Then, well, maybe we should be looking at Westminster.
We should be looking at who they will become as adults, Mr. Wallacker went on. It's a harsh world out there. The barometer of success in later life is not that they always win, but how they deal with failure. An ability to pick themselves up when they fall, retaining their optimism and sense of self, is a far greater predictor of future success than class position in year three.
Blimey! Had Mr. Wallacker suddenly been reading Buddha's little instruction book?
It's not a harsh world if you know how to win, purred Nicolette. What is Atticus's form position, please?
We don't give form positions, said Mr. Wallacker, getting to his feet. Is there anything else?
Yes. His French, said Nicolette, undaunted. And then they all sat down again.
10 p.m. Perhaps Mr. Wallacker is right about there being always someone greater and lesser than yourself at things. Was just walking back to car when posh, exhausted mother, trying to wrangle three overdressed children, suddenly burst out, Clemency, you fucking bleeding little c-
50 Shades of Old. Friday, the 22nd of November, 2013. £137. Helpless slide back towards obesity. Calories, 3,384. Diet Cokes, 7. Red Bulls, 3. Ham and cheese paninis, 2. Exercise, 0. Months since did roots, 2. Weeks since waxed legs, 5. Weeks since painted toenails, 6. Number of months since any sexual experience whatsoever, 5. Born again virgin again. I'm letting self go to seed, unwaxed, unplucked, unexercised, unexfoliated, unmani-pedicured, unmeditated, roots untouched up, hair unblow-dried, undressed, never, worst luck, and stuffing face to make up for it. Something has to be done. Saturday, 23rd November, 2013, 3 p.m. Just came out of the hairdresser's, where my roots were restored to their youthful glory. Immediately came face to face with a poster at the bus stop of Sharon Osbourne and her daughter Kelly. Sharon Osbourne with auburn hair and Kelly with grey hair. So confused. Is looking old the new bohemian floaty scarf now? Am I going to have to go back, have the grey roots restored, and ask the Botox man to add some wrinkles? Was just pondering this question when a voice said, Hello. Mr. Wallacker, I said, fluffing up my new hair coquettishly. Hello. He was wearing a warm, sexy jacket and scarf, looking down at me in the old way, cool, with a slightly amused twitch in the corner of his mouth. Look, I said, I just want to say I'm sorry I said all that at the school concert and was so lippy with you all those times when you were just being kind, but I thought you were married. And the thing is, I know everything. I mean, not everything, but I know about you being in the SAS, and his expression changed.
What did you say?
Jake and Rebecca live across the road, and... He was looking away from me, down the street, the muscle in his jaw working. It's all right, I haven't told anybody. And the thing is, you see, I know what it's like when something really bad happens.
I don't want to talk about it, he said abruptly.
I know you think I'm an awful mother and spend the whole time in the hairdressers and buying condoms, but I'm actually not like that. Those gonorrhea leaflets. Mabel had just picked them up at the doctor's. I don't have gonorrhea or syphilis. Am I interrupting?
A stunning girl was emerging from Starbucks, holding two coffees.
Hi.
She handed him one of the coffees and smiled at me. This is Miranda, said Mr. Wallacker stiffly. Miranda was beautiful and young, with long, shiny black hair topped with a trendy woolen cap. She had long, thin legs in jeans and studded ankle boots. Miranda, this is Mrs. Darcy, one of our school mothers.
Bridget,
said a voice. The hairdresser, who had just done my roots, was hurrying up the street.
You left your wallet in the salon. How's the colour? No more shades of grey for you for Christmas.
It is very nice, thank you.
Happy Christmas, I said, like a traumatized automaton granny. Happy Christmas, Mr. Wallacker. Happy Christmas, Miranda, I said, although it was not Christmas. They looked at me oddly as I walked shakily away.
9:15 p.m. The children are asleep, and I am very old and lonely. No one will ever fancy me again, ever, ever, ever. Mr. Wallacker is at this moment shagging Miranda. Everybody's life is perfect, except mine. The sound of shells cracking. Monday, 25th of November, 2013. £136. Number of pounds heavier than Miranda, 46. 9:15 a.m. Right. I am used to this now. I know what to do. We do not wallow. We do not descend into feelings of being crap with men. We do not think everyone else's life is perfect except ours, except bloody Miranda's. We concentrate on our inner great tree and we go to yoga. 1 p.m. Blimey. Started off in yoga, but realised had drunk too much Diet Coke again. Suffice it to say, it didn't go very well during pigeon pose. Went instead into the meditation class next door, which you could argue was a bit of a waste of money, because it had cost 15 quid, and all we did was sit cross-legged, trying to keep our minds blank. Found self looking round the room, thinking about Mr. Wallacker and Miranda, then nearly farted in shock. I didn't recognise him at first, but there, sitting in loose-fitting grey clothes on a purple mat, eyes closed, palms raised on his knees, was none other than George from Green Light. At least I was pretty sure it was him, but it was hard to tell. Then I saw the big glasses and iPhone next to the purple mat, and I knew it was definitely George. On the way out, I wasn't sure whether to say hello or not, but then I thought we had been communing on some sort of level, if subliminal, for the last hour, so I said, "George?" He put the glasses on and looked at me suspiciously, as though I was going to force a spec script on him right there. "It's me," I said. "Remember? The leaves in his hair."
"What?"
"Oh, right. Hey, I didn't know you were into meditation."
"Yeah, I'm done with the movie business. It's all studio movies. No respect for art. Meaningless, empty, nest of vipers. I was falling apart, just about to..." "Hang on."
George checked his iPhone.
"Sorry. Just about to get on a plane. I'm going to an ashram for 3 months in Lahore. Great to catch up."
"Excuse me," I ventured. He turned, looking impatient. "Are you sure the ashram isn't in Latuke?" He laughed then, probably only just remembering who I was. And we had a rather alarming hug. And he said,
"Namaste,"
in a deep movie producer voice, with an ironic expression, then rushed off again, still checking his iPhone. And I realised, in spite of everything, I was actually quite fond of George from Green Light. Tuesday, 26th of November, 2013. £135. Number of pounds heavier than Miranda, 45. Better. Calories, 4,826. Ham and cheese paninis, 2. Pizzas, 1.5. Tubs of Haagen-Dazs frozen yoghurt, 2. Alcohol units, 6. Very bad behaviour. 9 a.m. Just dropped off kids. Feel fat. Maybe we'll go and get ham and cheese panini. 10:30 a.m. Suddenly realised, as we're standing in the queue, that perfect Nicolette was there, waiting for her hot beverage. She was wearing a white faux fur jacket and sunglasses and carrying an enormous handbag. She looked like Kate Moss arriving at a black tie event, only it was 9 in the morning. Was tempted to bolt, but had been waiting ages. So, when Nicolette eventually turned and spotted me, I said brightly, "Hello." Instead of the frosty greeting I was expecting, Nicolette just stared at me, holding a paper cup in one hand. "I've got a new bag. It's Hermes," she said, holding up the handbag. Then her shoulders started to shake. "Skinny venti decaf cap, keep the change," I rattled off, shoving a fiver at the barista and thinking, if Nicolette's having a breakdown, then that's it. It's a cut-and-dried case. Everybody, left, right and centre, is a mess of cracked shells. "Come downstairs," I said to Nicolette, patting her shoulder awkwardly. Fortunately, there was no one else in the basement. "I've got a new bag," she said. "And this is the receipt." I stared blankly at the receipt. "My husband bought it for me, from Frankfurt Airport." "Well, that's nice. It's beautiful," I lied. The handbag was mad. It had no rhyme or reason, buckles and straps and loops bursting out everywhere like lunatics. "Look at the receipt," she said, pointing at it. "It's for 2 handbags." I blinked at the receipt. It did seem to be for 2 handbags, but so? "It's just a mistake," I said. "Ring them and get the money back." She shook her head. "I know who she is. I called her. It's been going on for 8 months. He bought her the identical bag." Her face crumpled. "It was a present, and he bought the same one for her." Got home and checked my emails. Sender, Nicolette Martinez. Subject, the school fucking concert. "Just to let you know, I don't give a flying fuck who brings the mince pies or mulled wine this year, and you can all turn up whenever the fuck you like, because I don't fucking well give a fuck. Nicorette, I need it." Think I will give Nicolette a ring. 11 p.m. Just had brilliant night at our place with Nicolette, with the 3 boys running riot on Roblox, and Mabel watching SpongeBob SquarePants while we had some wine, pizza, cheese, Diet Coke, Red Bull, Cadbury's chocolate buttons, Rolos and Haagen-Dazs. And Nicolette looked at OK Cupid shouting, "Bastards! Fuck Wittage!" In the middle, Tom turned up, slightly plastered, going on about a new survey. "It proves that the quality of someone's relationships is the biggest indicator of their long-term emotional health. Not so much the significant other relationship, as the measure of happiness is not your husband or boyfriend, but the quality of the other relationships you have around you." Anyway, just thought I'd tell you. I've got to go meet Arcus now. Nicolette is now asleep in my bed, and 4 kids are all squeezed in the bunk beds. You see? Don't need men anyway. A hero will rise. Friday, 29th of November, 2013. This is what happened. Billy had a football match at another school, East Finchley, a few miles away. We'd been told to park in the street to pick them up, as cars weren't allowed in the grounds. The school was a tall red brick building, with a small concrete yard in front of the gates, and to the left, a sunken sports court, 4 feet down, surrounded by a heavy chain-link fence. The boys were running round the sports court, kicking balls, the mothers chatting round the East Finchley steps. Suddenly, a black BMW roared right up to the school, the driver, an idiotically flashy-looking father, talking on his mobile. Mr. Wallacker strode to the car. "Excuse me." The father ignored him, continuing to talk on his phone, engine still running. Mr. Wallacker rapped on the window. "Cars are not allowed in the school grounds. Park in the street, please." The window slid open. "Time is money for some of us, my friend." "It's a safety issue." "Pah, safety. I'll be 2 minutes." Mr. Wallacker gave him the stare. "Move the car." Still holding the phone to his ear, the father angrily slammed the BMW into gear, reversing without looking, turned the wheel with a screech, and backed towards the sports court, straight into the heavy steel pole supporting the fence. As everyone turned to stare, the father, red-faced, jammed his foot on the accelerator, forgetting to take the car out of reverse, and rammed the post again. There was a sickening crack, and the post started to topple. "Boys," yelled Mr. Wallacker, "get away from the fence! Scramble!" It all seemed to be in slow motion. As the boys scattered and ran, the heavy metal post tottered, then fell into the sports court, pulling the fence with it, and landing with a terrifying bounce and crash. At the same time, the car slid backwards, the front wheels still on the concrete yard, the rear wheels half over the pit of the sports court below. Everyone froze, stunned, except Mr. Wallacker, who leaped down into the pit yelling, "Call 999! Wait the front of the car! Boys, line up at the other end!" Unbelievably, the BMW dad was starting to open his door. "You! Stay still!" yelled Mr. Wallacker. But the car was already sliding further backwards, the wheels now completely hanging over the drop. I scanned the boys at the other end of the court. Billy. Where was Billy? "Take Mabel," I said to Nicolette, and ran to the side of the sports court. Mr. Wallacker was below me in the pit, calm, eyes flicking over the scene. I forced myself to look. The heavy metal post was now wedged at a diagonal, one end against the wall of the pit and the other on the ground. The fence lay at an angle, buckled, hanging from the post like a ridge tent. Cowering in the small gap beneath the post, caged by the fallen fence, were Billy, Bikram and Jeremiah, their little faces staring terrified at Mr. Wallacker. The wall was behind them, the fence trapping them in front and at the sides, the rear of the big car hanging above them. I let out a gasp and jumped down into the pit.
"It'll be all right," Mr. Wallacker said quietly. "I've got this."
He crouched down.
"Okay, superheroes, this is your big break. Wriggle back to the wall and curl up. Brace positions."
Looking more excited than scared now, the boys wriggled themselves back and curled up, arms over their little heads.
"Good work, troopers," Mr. Wallacker said, and started to lift the heavy fence from the ground. "Now."
Suddenly, with a sickening screech of metal against concrete, the BMW slid further backwards, dislodging bits of debris, the back end swinging precariously in midair. There were screams from the mothers above and the wail of sirens.
"Stay against the wall, boys," said Mr. Wallacker, unfazed. "This is going to be good."
He stooped under the car, stepping carefully onto the fallen fence. He raised his arms and thrust the whole of his strength against the chassis. I could see the muscles straining in his forearms, in his neck, beneath his shirt.
"Weight the front of the car,"
he yelled up to the yard, sweat beading his forehead.
"Ladies, elbows on the bonnet."
I glanced up to see teachers and mothers leaping out of their shock, throwing themselves like startled chickens on the bonnet. Slowly, as Mr. Wallacker strained upwards, the rear of the car lifted.
"Okay, boys," he said, still pushing upwards. "Stay close to the wall. Crawl to your right, away from the car, then get yourselves out from under that fence."
I rushed to the edge of the fallen chain fence, more parents and teachers joining me now. Between us, we struggled to lift the buckled metal, the three boys wriggling towards the edge, Billy, the last one in line. Firemen were jumping down, lifting the fence, pulling Bikram out, the metal ripping his shirt, then Jeremiah. Billy was still in there. As Jeremiah wriggled free, I reached forward and put my arms under Billy's, feeling as though I had the strength of 10 men, and pulled, sobbing with relief as Billy came free, and the firemen pulled us out of the pit.
"That's the last one. Come on,"
yelled Mr. Wallacker, still shaking under the weight of the car. The firemen jumped under to support him, stepping on the fence, their weight crushing it down into the space where, seconds before, the three boys had been cowering.
"Where's Mabel?" yelled Billy dramatically. "We have to save her."
The three boys charged off through the crowd in the yard with the air of supermen with flapping capes. I followed to find Mabel standing calmly beside a hyperventilating Nicolette. Billy threw his arms round Mabel, yelling,
"I've saved her! I've saved my sister! Are you all right, sister?"
"Yes," she said solemnly. "But Mr. Wallacker's bothy."
Incredibly, in the midst of the pandemonium, the BMW dad again opened the car door, and this time he actually climbed out, brushing huffily at his overcoat, at which the whole vehicle started sliding backwards.
"It's coming down," Mr. Wallacker yelled from below. "Get out, guys."
We all rushed forward to see Mr. Wallacker and the fireman jumping clear as the BMW crashed down onto the steel pole, then bounced, rolled, and smashed on its side, sleek metal cracking, windows shattering, broken glass and debris all over the cream leather seats.
"My Beamer," shouted the dad. "Time is money, dickhead," Mr. Wallacker retorted, grinning delightedly.
As the paramedics tried to look him over, Billy was explaining.
"We couldn't move, you see, Mummy. We daren't run because that post was wobbling right above us. But then we were superheroes because..."
Meanwhile, chaos was breaking out around us. Parents running crazily round in circles, hair extensions flying, enormous handbags lying forgotten on the ground. Mr. Wallacker jumped onto the steps.
Quiet, he shouted. Everyone, stand still. Now, boys, in a second you'll be lining up to be checked and counted. But first listen up. You've just had a real adventure. No one got hurt. You were brave, you were calm, and three of you, Bikram, Jeremiah and Billy, were cut-and-dried superheroes. Tonight you're going to go home and celebrate, because you've proved that when scary stuff happens, which it will, you know how to be brave and calm. Cheers went up from the boys and parents. Oh, my God, said Fazia, take me now, rather echoing my own sentiments. As Mr. Wallacker passed me, he shot me a smug little look, endearingly Billy-like. All in a day's work, I said. Seen worse, he said cheerfully. At least your hair didn't blow up. After the counting, Bikram, Billy and Jeremiah were mobbed by the other boys. The three of them had to go to hospital to be checked out. When they climbed into the ambulances, followed by their traumatized mothers, it was with the air of a newly famous boy band from Britain's Got Talent. Mabel fell asleep in the ambulance and slept through the checkups. The boys were fine, apart from a few scratches. Bikram's and Jeremiah's fathers turned up at the hospital. A few minutes later, Mr. Wallacker appeared, grinning, with bags of McDonald's, and went over every detail of what had happened with the boys, answering all their questions and explaining exactly how and why they'd been action heroes. As Jeremiah and Bikram left with their parents, Mr. Wallacker held out my car keys. You okay? He took one look at my face and said, I'll drive you home. No, I'm absolutely fine, I lied. Listen, he said with his slight smile, it doesn't make you less of a top professional feminist if you let somebody help you. Back home, as I settled the children on the sofa, Mr. Wallacker said quietly, What do you need? They're cuddly toys. They're upstairs in the bunk beds. Puffle too? Yes. And one and three, Mario, Horsio and Saliva. Saliva? Her dolly. As he came back with the toys, I was trying to turn on the TV, staring at the remotes. Shall I have a go? SpongeBob sprang into life, and he led me behind the sofa. I started sobbing then, silently. Shh, 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 he whispered, putting his strong arms around me. No one was hurt. I knew it was going to be fine. I leaned against him, sniffing and snuffling. You're doing all right, Bridget, he said softly. You're a good mum and dad. Better than some who have a staff of eight and a flat in Monte Carlo, even if you have put snot on my shirt. And it felt like the aeroplane door opening when you arrive on holiday with a rush of warm air. It felt like sitting down at the end of the day. Then Mabel yelled, Mummy, SpongeBob finished! And simultaneously the doorbell rang. It was Rebecca. We just heard about the school thing, she said, clattering down the stairs. A string of tiny LED Christmas lights woven into her hair. What happened? Oh, she said, seeing Mr. Wallacker. Hello, Scott. Hello, he said. Good to see you. Headgear unexpectedly understated, but still. Finn, Oleander and Jake came over, and the house was filled with noise and chocolate and Helvanians and Xbox and everyone running about. I kept trying to talk to Billy and help him process what had happened, but he just said, Mummy, I'm a superhero, okay? I watched Mr. Wallacker talking to Jake, both of them tall, handsome, old friends, fathers. Rebecca looked at Mr. Wallacker and raised her eyebrows at me, but then his phone rang, and I could just tell he was talking to Miranda. I have to go, he said abruptly, clicking it off. You guys will look after them tonight, right, Jake? Heart sinking, I followed him up to the doorstep and started to gabble. I'm so grateful. It's you who is the superhero. I mean, is. Ah, he said, and it was my pleasure. He walked down the steps, then turned, added softly, superheroine, and strode off towards the main road,
the taxis, and a girl who looks like she's out of a magazine. I watched him go, sadly, thinking, superheroine. I'd still like someone to shag. 'Tis the season. Monday, 2nd of December, 2013. Everything is all right. Took Billy to the child psychologist, who said he seemed to have healthily assimilated it as a learning experience. When I tried to take him for a second time, Billy said, "Mummy, it's you who needs to go." Billy and Bikram and Jeremiah are enjoying a period of what can only be described as celebrity at the school and have been signing autographs. Their school's celebrity, however, is as nothing beside that of Mr. Wallacker. And Mr. Wallacker is friendly to me now, and I to him. But that's as far as it seems to go. Tuesday, 3rd of December, 2013. 3:30 p.m. Mabel just came out of school singing, "Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la, 'tis the season to be jolly." It is the season to be jolly. I'm going to be jolly this year. And grateful. Wednesday, 4th of December, 2013, 4:30 p.m. Oh. Mabel has now changed the words to, "'Tis the season to hate Billy." Thursday, 5th of December, 2013, 10 a.m. Felonius's mother stopped me at the infant's branch drop-off this morning. "Bridget," she said, "could you ask your daughter to stop upsetting Felonius?" "Why, what?" I said, confused. It turns out Mabel is going round the playground singing, "Deck the halls with boughs of begonias, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la, 'tis the season to hate Felonius, la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la." 2 p.m. "That'll teach you to plant such an unimaginative flower," said Rebecca. "How's Scott? I mean, Mr. Wallacker." "He's nice," I said. "He's friendly, but, you know, just friendly." "Well, are you just friendly to him? Does he know? He's with Miranda." "A man like that has his needs. It doesn't mean he's going to be with her forever." I shook my head. "He's not interested. I think he likes me as a person now, but that's as far as it goes." It is sad. But mostly, I am happy. It only takes a really bad thing to nearly happen to make you appreciate what you have. 2:05 p.m. Bloody Miranda. 2:10 p.m. Hate Miranda. Oh, look at me. I'm all young and tall and thin and perfect. She's probably also going out with Rockster. Humph. The Carol Concert. Wednesday, 11th of December, 2013. The Carol Concert was upon us again, and Billy and Mabel both had sleepovers, so there was wild excitement combined with the utter hysteria of trying to pack 2 overnight backpacks, get Mabel and me looking human and festive enough to go to a school carol concert, and get there before it actually ended. Was trying to put on my best front, as no doubt Miranda would be in the church, cheering on her man. Mabel was wearing a furry jacket and a sticky-out red skirt, which I'd got in the I Love Gorgeous sale. I was wearing a new white coat, inspired by Nicolette, who is currently in the Maldives, where her sexually incontinent husband is begging her forgiveness while she tortures him in a luxury hut at the end of a long wooden walkway suspended over the sea on stilts, sharks circling below. In the absence of any possibility of blowjobs, I had gone for a blow-dry, though the Disney princess and Mario backpacks didn't exactly add to the look. Plus, Miranda would undoubtedly be wearing an effortlessly sexy yet understated outfit so edgily on-trend that even Mabel would not understand it. As we came out of the tube station, the village looked utterly magical, delicate lights casting shadows in the trees. The shops were all lit up, and a brass band was playing Good King Wenceslas, and the old-fashioned butcher had turkeys hanging up in the window. And we were early. Out of a moment's believing I actually was Good King Wenceslas, I rushed into the butcher and bought 4 Cumberland sausages, in case a poor man suddenly came in sight, adding a sausage bag to the 2 lurid backpacks. Then Mabel wanted to get a hot chocolate, which seemed like the perfect idea. But then suddenly it was 5:45, which was the time we were meant to be seated by, so we had to run towards the church, and Mabel tripped, and her hot chocolate went all over my coat. She burst into tears.
"Your coat, Mummy! Your new coat!"
"It doesn't matter, sweetheart," I said. "It doesn't matter. It's just a coat. Here, have my hot chocolate." Meanwhile thinking, oh, fuck. The one time I managed to get it together, I'd fuck it up again. But the church square was so beautiful, lined with Georgian houses with Christmas trees in the windows and Christmas wreaths on the doors. The church windows were glowing orange. Organ music was playing, and the fir tree outside was decorated with Christmas lights. And there were some seats left inside, quite near the front. There was no sign of Miranda. Heart gave a great leap as Mr. Wallacker appeared, looking cheerful yet masterful in a blue shirt and dark jacket.
"Look, there's Billy,"
said Mabel, as the choir and musicians filed into the pews. We had been strictly instructed by Billy not to wave. But Mabel waved, and then I couldn't help it. Mr. Wallacker glanced at Billy, who rolled his eyes and giggled. Then everyone settled, and the vicar walked down the aisle and said the blessing. Billy kept looking over at us and grinning. He was so proud of himself being in the choir. Then it was time for the first carol, and everyone got to their feet. Spartacus, as usual, was singing the solo. And as that pure, perfect little voice rang out through the church, "Once in royal David's city stood a lowly cattle shed, where a mother laid her baby in a manger for his bed." I realized I was going to cry. The organ swelled into action, and the congregation started to sing the second verse. "He came down to earth from heaven, who is God and Lord of all. And his shelter was a stable, and his cradle was a stall." And all the Christmases before came flooding back. The Christmases when I was little, standing between Mum and Dad in Grafton Underwood Village Church on Christmas Eve, waiting for Santa Claus. The Christmases when I was a teenager, Dad and I suppressing giggles as Mum and Una warbled overly loudly in ridiculous sopranos. The Christmases in my 30s, when I was single and so sad, because I thought I'd never have a baby of my own to lay in a manger, or more precisely, a bugaboo stroller. Last winter in the snow, when I was tweeting Rockster, who was probably at this moment dancing to garage house music with someone called Natalie, or Miranda, or Saffron. Dad's last Christmas before he died, when he staggered out of hospital to go to midnight mass in Grafton Underwood. The first Christmas, when Mark and I went to church, holding Billy in a little Santa Claus outfit. The Christmas when Billy had his first nativity play at nursery school, which was the first Christmas after Mark's brutal, horrible death, when I couldn't believe that Christmas would be so cruel as to actually try to happen.
"Don't cry, Mummy. Please don't cry."
Mabel was gripping my hand tightly. Billy was looking over. I wiped the tears away with my fist, raised my head to join in.
"And he feeleth for our sadness, and he shareth in our gladness."
And saw that Mr. Wallacker was looking straight at me. The congregation carried on singing.
"And our eyes at last shall see him."
But Mr. Wallacker had stopped singing and was just looking at me. And I looked back, with my face covered in mascara and my coat covered in hot chocolate. Then Mr. Wallacker smiled, the slightest, kindest smile, the one smile that understood, over the heads of all those boys he'd taught to sing once in Royal David's City. And I knew that I loved Mr. Wallacker. As we came out of the church, it had begun to snow, thick flakes swirling down, settling on the festive coats and on the Christmas tree.
There was a brazier lit in the churchyard, and the senior boys were handing out mulled wine, roast chestnuts and hot chocolate.
"May I pour some more of this down your coat?"
I turned, and there he was, holding a tray of two hot chocolates and two mulled wines.
"This is for you, Mabel," he said, putting down the tray and crouching to hold out a hot chocolate.
She shook her head.
"I've spilt it before, on Mummy's coat, you see."
"Now, Mabel," he said solemnly, "if she had a white coat on without chocolate, would she really be Mummy?"
She looked at him with her huge grave eyes, shook her head and took the chocolate. Then, quite unlike Mabel, she put down her drink and suddenly threw her arms around him, buried her little head in his shoulder and gave him a kiss, chocolatey, on his shirt.
"There you go," he said. "Why don't you tip a little bit more on Mummy's coat, just for Christmas?"
He stood up and pretended to lurch towards me with the mulled wines.
"Merry Christmas," he said.
We touched paper cups, and our eyes met again, and even with the mess of kids and parents thronging around us, somehow neither of us could look away.
"Mummy!"
It was Billy.
"Mummy, did you see me?"
"'Tis the thief and two hate Billy," sang Mabel.
"Mabel," said Mr. Wallacker, "stop it."
Which she did.
"Of course she saw you, Billy. She was waving at you, and she was specifically instructed not to. Here's your hot chocolate, Bilster."
He put his hand on Billy's shoulder. "You were great." As Billy grinned the fantastic ear-to-ear, sparkle-eyed grin, the old grin, I caught Mr. Wallacker's look, both of us remembering how close Billy had come to...
"Mummy!"
Billy interrupted. "What did you do to your coat?"
"Oh, look, there's Bikram. Did you bring my bag? Can I go?" me too," said Mabel.
"Where?" said Mr. Wallacker.
"Sleepover," said Billy. "I'm going too," said Mabel proudly, "having a sleepover with Kovmata."
"Well, that sounds like fun," said Mr. Wallacker. "And is Mummy having a sleepover too?"
"No," said Mabel. "Thieve all on her own. As usual," said Billy.
"Interesting."
"Mr. Wallacker,"
it was Valerie, the school secretary, "there's a bassoon left in the church. What do we do? We can't leave it in the church, and it's absolutely
Oh, God, I'm sorry," I said. "It's Billy's. I'll go and get it."
"I'll get it," said Mr. Wallacker. "Back in a mo."
"No, it's okay, I'll..."
Mr. Wallacker put his hand firmly on my arm.
"I'll get it."
Blinking, head swirling through confused thoughts and emotions, I watched him go off for the bassoon. I packed Mabel and Billy off with their bags and stood by the brazier, watching them go with Bikram and Kosmata and their mums and dads. After a few minutes, all the other families started leaving too, and I was beginning to feel a bit of a fool. Maybe Mr. Wallacker didn't mean he was coming back at all. I couldn't see him anywhere. I mean, maybe "back in a mo" was just the sort of thing people say when they're moving around at a social occasion. Though he was going for the bassoon. But maybe he'd locked it in a cupboard ready for the next lesson and gone to meet Miranda. And maybe he just gave me the nice look in church because he was sorry for me because I was blubbing during Once in Royal David City. And he only brought the hot chocolate because I was a tragic widow with tragic fatherless children and... I downed a last mouthful of the mulled wine and, chucking my cup in the bin, splattering my coat with red wine to go with the chocolate, set off towards the square following the last stragglers.
"Hang on!"
He was striding towards me, holding the enormous bassoon. The stragglers turned to look.
It's all right, I'm taking her carol singing," he said, then murmuring as he reached my side, "Shall we hit the pub?"
The pub was all cosy, old and Christmassy, with flagstone floors, crackling fires, and ancient beams decked with boughs of holly, though also full of parents looking at us with intense interest. Mr. Wallacker cheerfully ignored the stairs, found a booth at the back where no one could see, pulled out my chair for me, put the bassoon next to my chair saying, "Try not to lose it," and went to get us drinks.
"So," he said, sitting down opposite, placing the glasses in front of us.
"Mr. Wallacker," said one of the Year Six mothers, peering round the booth, "I just wanted to say it was the most marvellous..."
"Thank you, Mrs. Pavlichko," he said, getting to his feet. "I deeply appreciate your appreciation. I hope you have a wonderful Christmas, truly. Goodbye. And she scuttled off, politely dismissed. So, he said, sitting down again.
So, I said, I just want to say thank you again for...
So what's with your toy boy? The one I saw you with on the heath?
So what's with Miranda? I said, smoothly ignoring his impertinence.
Miranda? Miranda? He looked at me incredulously. Bridget, she's 22. She's my brother's stepdaughter.
I looked down, blinking rapidly, trying to take it all in. So you're going out with your stepniece?
No. She bumped into me when she was shoe shopping. You're the one who's engaged to be married to a child.
I'm not.
You are, he said, laughing. I'm not.
So stop squabbling and dish. I told him the whole story about Rockster. Well, not the whole story. Edited highlights.
How old was he exactly?
29. Well, no, he was 30 by the time...
Oh, well, in that case. His eyes were crinkling at the corners. He's practically a sugar daddy.
So you've been single all this time?
Well, I'm not saying I've been living the life of a monk.
He swirled the scotch around in his glass. Oh, God, those eyes.
But the thing is, you see, he leaned forward confidentially. You can't go out with someone else, can you? When you're in love.
Mr. Walliker. It was Angelica Sanssouci. She looked at us, mouth open. Sorry, she said, and disappeared. I was staring at him, trying to believe what he'd seemed to be about to say.
Okay, enough school mums, he said. If I take you home, will you dance to Kill a Queen?
I was still in a daze as we made our way through the parents and the compliments.
Magnificent performances, overwhelmingly accomplished, fiercely impressive.
As we were heading out of the pub door, we saw Valerie. Have a good night, you two, she said, with a twinkle. Outside, it was still snowing. I glanced lustfully at Mr. Walliker. He was so tall, so gorgeous. The ruggedly handsome jaw above the scarf, the slight glimpse of hairy chest below his shirt collar, the long legs in his dark... Shit! The bassoon! I, for some reason, suddenly remembered and started heading back in. He stopped me again with a gentle hand on my arm.
I'll get it.
I waited, breathless, feeling the snow on my cheeks. Then he reappeared with the bassoon and the plastic bag of sausages.
Your sausages, he said, handing them to me.
Oh, yes, sausages. Goodkin Wenceslas, the butcher, I gabbled nervously. We were standing very close.
Look, he said, pointing above. Isn't that mistletoe?
I think you'll find it's an elm with no leaves.
I continued to gabble without looking up.
I mean, it probably just looks like mistletoe because of the snow and...
Bridget.
He reached out and gently traced my cheekbone with his finger, the cool blue eyes burning into mine, teasing, tender, hungry.
This isn't a biology lesson.
He raised my mouth to his and kissed me once, lightly, then again more urgently, and added,
yet. Oh, God. He was so masterful. He was such a man.
And then we were kissing properly, and it felt once more like everything was going crazy inside me. Flashes and pulses, and like I was driving a super-fast car in a pair of stilettos again. But this time it was all right, because the person actually at the wheel was... Mr. Walliker, I gasped.
So sorry, he murmured. Did I catch you with the bassoon?
We both agreed we should take the bassoon safely back to his place, which was a huge flat in one of the lanes off the high street. It had old wooden floors and a blazing fire, with a fur hearthrug and candles and the smell of cooking. A small, smiling Filipino lady was bustling around the kitchen area.
Martha, he said, thank you. It looks wonderful. You can go now. Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Walliker's in a hurry, she smiled. I'm on my way. How'd the concert go? It was great, I said.
Yes, great, he said, bustling her out, kissing her on the top of her head. Brass band a bit off, but generally good.
You take care of him, she said as she left. He the best, Mr. Wallacker, the best man.
I know, I said. As the door closed, we stood like children left alone in a sweet shop. Look at this coat, he murmured. You're such a mess. That's why I... And then he started slowly unbuttoning the coat, slipping it off my shoulders. For a moment I thought, maybe this was a practiced routine. Maybe that's why Martha was so quick to leave. But then he said, that's partly why... He pulled me close, his hands slipping to my back, starting to slowly undo my zip. I fell in... Fell in... I felt my eyes filling with tears, and for a second I could swear his were too. Then he pulled himself back into masterful mode and laid my head against his shoulder. I'm going to kiss away all your tears. All your tears, he growled, after I've finished with you. Then he carried on with the zip, which went all the way down, so that the dress fell to the floor, leaving me in my boots and, Merry Christmas, Talitha, black La Perla slip. When we were both naked, I couldn't believe the naughty perfection of Mr. Wallacker's familiar, handsome, schoolgate's head on top of that incredibly ripped, naked body. Mr. Wallacker, I gasped again. Will you stop calling me Mr. Wallacker?
Yes, Mr. Wallacker.
Okay, that's a cut-and-dried caution, which is going to lead inevitably... He picked me up in his arms, as if I was as light as a feather, which I am not, unless it was a very heavy feather, maybe from a giant, prehistoric dinosaur-type bird. To a misdemeanor, he said, laying me gently by the fire. He kissed my neck, moving slowly, exquisitely downwards.
Oh, oh, I gasped. Did they teach you this in the SAS?
Naturally, he said, eventually, raising himself up, looking down with his amused expression. The British Special Forces have the finest training in the world. But ultimately, he was pressing now, gently, deliciously at first, then more and more insistently, till I was melting like a... Ultimately, it's all about...
I gasped.
The pistol.
All hell broke loose then. It was like being in heaven or other similar paradise. I came and I came and I came, repeatedly, in a tribute to Her Majesty and the training of her forces, till finally he said,
I don't think I can hold on any longer.
Just go for it, I managed. And finally, we both, in a perfect, miraculous, simultaneous explosion of months of desire at the school gates, did. Afterwards, we lay back, panting, exhausted. Then we slept in each other's arms, then woke, and did it again, and again, all night. At 5 a.m, we had some of Martha's soup. We huddled by the fire and talked. He told me what had happened in Afghanistan. An accident. A mistaken attack. Women, children killed, finding the aftermath. Deciding he'd done his bit, and he was through. And this time, I put my arms around him and stroked his head.
I do take your point, he murmured.
What?
Cuddling. Quite good, really. He talked about starting at the school. He wanted to be away from the violence, make life simple, be with children, and do some good things. He wasn't prepared for the mothers, though, the competitiveness and the complication. But then one of them was kind enough to show off her thong when stuck up a tree, and I started to think that life could possibly be a bit more fun.
And you like it now?
I whispered. Yes. He started to kiss me again. Oh, yes. He was kissing different parts of me between his words. I really, definitively, conclusively like it now. Suffice it to say,
When I picked Billy and Mabel up from Bikram's and Cosmata's later that day, I was walking with extreme difficulty.
"Why are you still wearing the chocolatey coat?" said Mabel.
"Tell you when you're grown up," I said. The Owl. Thursday, 12th of December, 2013. 9 p.m. Just put the children to bed. Mabel was staring out of the window.
"The moon is still following off."
"Well, the thing is, with the moon," I started to explain.
"And that owl,"
Mabel interrupted. I looked out at the snowy garden. The moon was white and full above it. And on the garden wall, the barn owl was back. He stared at me, calm, unblinking. Then this time, he spread his wings, looked for a last moment, and flew upwards, his wings beating almost to the beat of my heart, into the winter night and the darkness and its mysteries. The Year's Progress. Tuesday, 31st of December, 2013. Pounds lost, 17. Pounds gained, 18. Twitter followers, 797. Twitter followers lost, 793. Twitter followers gained, 794. Jobs gained, 1. Jobs lost, 1. Text sent, 24,383. Texts received, 24,284. Good. Number of screenplay words written, 18,000. Number of words of screenplay rewritten, 17,984. Number of words of screenplay written and put back like were in first place, 16,822. Number of words of text written, 104,569. People infested by nits, 5. Total nits extracted, 152. Price per nit of professionally extracted nits, £8.59. Boyfriends lost, 1. Boyfriends gained, 2. Fires in house, 4. Existing children kept intact, 2. Children lost, 7, counting all occasions. Children found, 7. Total children, 4. Outcome. Mr. Wallacker, or Scott, as I occasionally call him, and I did not have a wedding, because neither of us wanted to get married again. But we did realise that neither of us had christened our children, so decided to make it an excuse for a coming-together party at the big country house. That way, we decided, the children would be covered, like insurance, in case it emerged that the Christian God was the true God, even though both Mr. Wallacker and I are slightly Buddhist. The ceremony was performed in the chapel. The school choir sang, and Scott's sons, Matt and Fred, who were no longer in boarding school but at the senior school, played "Someone to Watch Over Me" on clarinet and piano. I cried most of the time. Greenlight Productions sent a bunch of flowers the size of a sheep. Rebecca had her hair done in an afro, with a lit-up sign saying "Motel" and an arrow pointing down at her head. Daniel got drunk at the party and tried to get off with Talitha, leading to Sergei throwing a giant tantrum and storming off in a rage. And Jude, who had obviously got bored with wildlife photographer man's devotion, got off with Mr. Pitlochry Howard, and then had a terrible time getting out of it afterwards. Tom and Arcus sulked because we hadn't invited Gwyneth Paltrow, even though Jake had once played with Chris Martin, and both flirted outrageously with the senior boys in the big band. Mum was still slightly annoyed that I hadn't worn something more brightly coloured, but got over it because her coat dress set was clearly nicer than Una's, and Mr. Wallacker is quite happy to indulge her by flirting outrageously and telling her off when she gets out of line in a way that just makes her titter. Rockster, who had previously sent me a very nice text saying his heart was broken at the loss of his vomiting cougar, but there clearly was a dating god as his new girlfriend had morning sickness, texted me on the day to say she wasn't pregnant. It was just that he'd forced her to eat too much food, and she was really annoying, which was nice. And somewhere, up above it all, I knew in my heart that Mark would be glad, that he really, really would not have wanted us to be alone and in a confused state, and that if it had to be someone, he would be glad it was Mr. Wallacker. And now I have not two children, but four. And Billy has big boys to play Xbox with, and comes off perfectly happily and without any discussion about getting to the next level if Mr. Wallacker so much as looks at him. We hang out with Jake and Rebecca and the kids at weekends, and everyone has someone to play with. And Mabel, for the first time since she was too tiny a baby to know, has a daddy who is in this world and not the next, and treats her like such a princess that I constantly have to caution her. And I feel safe, and not lonely, and cared for. And we go to Capthorpe House sometimes at weekends, and reenact the scene in the bushes when the kids are in bed, with a better ending. And we all live together now, in a big old messy house near Hampstead Heath. And as we can all walk to school from there, we've decided we can manage with just the one car, which makes it so much easier with the parking permits, though we're still late every morning. Oh, and watch out for The Leaves in His Hair, retitled Thy Neighbour's Yacht, coming soon as a straight-to-DVD release near you. The children finally went to the dentist and don't have anything wrong with their teeth. And, by the way, currently all six of us have head lice. This is Samantha Bond. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy, by Helen Fielding. This programme was directed by Random House, LLC. Executive producers, Alexa Moore and Juliana Wilson. Text copyright, 2013, by Helen Fielding. Production copyright, 2013, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this programme.